Ladies and gentlemen, we, people of color, daughters and sons of immigrants, we belong to Europe. I am, we are the story of Europe. Welcome to this new episode of We Belong. My name is Yasmine Ouiran, and I will introduce to you today a performance artist who uses her body to paint. It's actually a tool that she uses to create her works. She is a British painter. She exhibited in galleries, but also on the internet, on social media. She is very viral. She's part of a collective that fights against the hypersexualization of women in social media, and her struggle around feminism but also colonialism are very, very inspiring. So we will talk about all these today, but also obviously about arts. Her name is Adelaide Damoa, and I'm happy to introduce her to you. So hello, Adelaide.
Hi. Hello, Yasmin.
Hi. Thank you for accepting our invitation. First of all, what is one word that you want to share with us? One word that describes your work or what you stand for?
Knowledge. Because
knowledge.
Yeah. Because for me, knowledge is empowerment. Knowledge is power. And right at the core of everything I do is the Ghanaian concept of Sankofa. Sankofa is an Akan word. It's an ancient Akan word that comes with a symbol. It's one of the Adinkra symbols, which means it is not long to go back and pick up that which is forgotten, which means it's important to understand your history so that you do not repeat the same mistakes of the past. So for me, that is at the core of literally everything I do when it comes to my art.
Thank you so much. I mean, that's super important. Also to know yourself, know your work, know what you stand for, understanding and, yeah, knowledge. I think it's key in order to progress in society. Your first exhibition, if I am right, was in 2006, and it was analyzing and exploring the role of race and identity in iconography, in art. I believe that you had inverted the skin colors of Greek British icons like David Beckham. What was your message in this exhibit? Can you tell more about it?
Oh my God, that was so long ago. I mean that exhibition was really, for me, it was a very naive exploration of race and identity in the UK. I had just started out really as an artist at that point. Prior to that, I had a completely different career. So I knew nothing about the art world. I knew nothing about art, really. I was completely self-taught, untrained. So I really was thinking very much about what it meant to be British as somebody who is Black British. Both of my parents are Ghanaian. Hence that whole thing about Sankofa and the Akan people. The Akan people are from Ghana in West Africa. Mm-hmm. So for me at that point in my life, having grown up with some quite serious racism in the 80s and 90s, and having experienced microaggressions in the workplace and just in general, walking around and existing as a Black person in the UK, I was interested in the fact that when certain people attained a certain status in this country, well, in the world generally, then they seemed to transcend race. Whether or not that is actually true, whether or not that is actually real, is a whole nother conversation. But they appeared to transcend their race. So I I guess in a very crude way, decided to make these portraits of people like you mentioned, David Beckham and Naomi Campbell, to try and imagine what their life would have been or could have been had their race been inverted.
Wow, yeah, it's powerful, and it's also powerful to use a public figure, an important known figures in your society, to question their role, your role. How did you experience this first exhibition, and especially what were the reaction? Because you touched on very sensitive issues such as race, skin color, identities.
I mean, the immediate reaction from the press was intense, especially for somebody who I wasn't a public figure. I wasn't trying to be a public figure. I was just trying to make work that I felt was important to me at the time. And so I had media attention from the BBC, Channel 5 News, and various other smaller local stations and channels. People were curious and wanted to know more. Somebody called me up to say that someone had mentioned it on LBC radio, and I think it was James O'Brien at the time, wasn't impressed. Somebody else had called in to the radio station to say, how dare I invert the skin colour of, I think it was Princess Diana, the Diana portrait. How dare I defile her image by making her into a black woman? I thought that was interesting.
Definitely.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, in terms of the general public, it was mostly positive and mostly curiosity, and one or two negative things like that. And of course, friends and family were very supportive. But for me, that was, looking back on it now, to me, it feels, kind of naive, and it's not a way that I would use to talk about those issues now. Definitely wouldn't be portraiture or using, celebrities in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it was part of your growing. It was the first of many steps that you took.
Definitely.
But it was also an important way to explore your Ghanaian origins also, because as you mentioned, you are originally from Ghana. You have faced many discriminations because of the color of your skin and your appearance. So it's important for you to question this, but also to understand your roots. And I think that you went to Ghana, I believe, to go back in the footstep of your colonized ancestors, precisely one of the subjects that touch you is colonization. So mm-hmm. Tell us more about it. Why is it something that for you it's super important to talk about today?
I was born and raised in the UK. So, mm-hmm. And my parents met in the UK in the 70s. Both of them are from Ghana, but they didn't meet each other until they came here. The reason they came here is because Ghana got independence in 1957. My mum was 11 years old when Ghana got independence, and my dad was a little bit younger. And so the British Empire, after independence and post-war, the British were going round to previously colonised countries and recruiting people to come to the UK to help to build the services like the National Health Service, rail services. And my mother was one of those people, and also my dad. I mean, my mum actually wanted to study law, and she came over here to study nursing because it was, she said it was the fashion at that time to come over to the UK to study and improve your life and get along. But that would not have happened had it not been for the British Empire. My parents would not have met had it not been for the British Empire. Therefore, I wouldn't have been born had it not been for the British Empire. So the British Empire is, in a lot of ways, the existence of the empire is what a lot of us have in common who are born and raised here. Well, a lot of us who exist in this country have in common is that British Empire. But we have blind spots when it comes to the British Empire. A lot of us don't understand that history and don't understand the reason why we live in the multicultural society that we do is in large part due to the British Empire. And so my mum took us to Ghana. She took me to Ghana first when I was 18 months old. Then she took us as kids. I think I must have been 8 or 9. And then I went again for the first time as an adult in 2016. And at that point, when I just went on holiday with my sister. And then I've always been obsessed with old photographs. So I'm constantly documenting them. I just take pictures of them with my phone or scan them if I can. And I was bugging my mum to take me to my grandparents' house so that I could find some old photographs of her, my grandma, and any relatives as far back as I could find. And I didn't know the reason for that. I just knew that I had this deep longing to see these photographs. So my mum took me to the house where she was raised, where she's got some family who still live there. And we found this photo of my great grandmother, really powerful looking lady. And in the photo, she's facing the camera and she's holding my grandmother, who I'm named after. Her name is also Adelaide. And my grandmother was born in 1920. So she was a tiny baby at this time. And, that photo was taken the year of her birth, 1920. My grandma was born, I actually had the same birthday as her.
Interesting.
Yeah, so when I saw this photo, I don't know, I was really drawn to it and I knew that somehow I needed to use it. So I asked my mum's permission if I could take a picture of it, because I didn't have a scanner with me there. So I just took a picture of the photo with my phone. And that really, I guess, precipitated this really very deep interest that I have in that relationship between our Britain's colonial past and specifically Ghana and more broadly Africa, and then the rest of the world, because at the end of the day, Britain colonised 24% of the Earth's landmass. And so that history is very important to me, but the starting point is Ghana, and then it goes outwards. So that was the start, and that's why it's so important to me, because it's so inherent to my personal family history, as well as in a broader context, the history of Britain.
Yeah, and it's, you know, such a personal story and something that you needed to do to go back to your roots. And I'm actually happy to hear that also your grandmother had the same name as you. And by the way, I'm sorry because I mistook it with my Italian accent. In Italy, we say Adelaide.
I know.
But you're actually just say Adelaide.
No, I like it. It reminds me, I dated an Italian for 6 years, and that's how he says my name, and his whole family calls me like that. And I know a lot of French people, they all say my name like that as well. So
amazing. Okay, well. But but I think it was an important step for you to take, especially because I don't think we talk enough about colonialism in Europe in general. What about in the UK, where you were born and raised, do you think it's enough addressed?
Not at all. Not even a little bit. I mean, post-colonial studies is nothing new. However, yeah. In this country, aside from in academic circles, nobody really talks about it. It's not talked about in schools. So for me, I didn't study history to any great length in school. Ironically, I hated history at secondary school. It might have had something to do with the way they taught it or the fact that the curriculum, I didn't think, was relevant to me because my history wasn't discussed even a little bit. Aside from a very cursory look at slavery, that was about it. You'd think that slavery was all that African history was about. And even colonial history, there's far more to African history than our colonial history. But this whole concept of decolonizing the mind, decolonizing education. Again, it's nothing new, but in academic circles, it has been something that has been deeply researched and discussed for many years, since probably the 60s and beyond. But it's something that is very little understood by the masses, and I think it really mm-hmm. needs to be in order to foster a greater understanding of why things are the way they are.
Definitely. And what I find interesting is also the fact that you not only talk about your condition as a post-colonial, new generation citizen living in the UK, but also and especially as a woman, because I think it's an added burden to, face all we face, carry the legacy we do, because it's a tough history that we carry, and also furthermore being a woman. And I know that in 2008 you exhibited at the Nolias Gallery. Can you explain us this fight that is, at the core of your work, that is also a feminist fight?
The Nolias Gallery exhibition was Supermodels again, another long time ago, but I consider myself to be a feminist, and it's really important to me to discuss feminism from an intersectional perspective also. So at the point where gender meets all sorts of other issues, whether it's race, whether it's sexuality, I think it's really important to discuss feminist issues from all of those angles so that nobody gets excluded from the conversation. Mm. But I suppose in my work, I don't know that I necessarily, aside from the inconsistency of the self performance work, where I specifically was doing a feminist response to Eve Klein's work, I don't know that I necessarily directly tackle feminist issues in my work, but mm-hmm. I think just my existence as a woman in this space is some kind of commentary. But for me, I'm very interested in feminist theory from a personal mm-hmm. perspective.
Yeah, and I think that also we can see it on Genesis, in your exhibition, where you use your body to explain, transmit a message. It's really, really, really beautiful the way you do, because it's not only the final product, but the process. It's, a performance that you show. So can you tell us more about how you do it and why, especially?
Okay, so, firstly, in terms of the way that I work now, there are there are different strands to the way that I work now, and the use of my body is one of those strands. And the other strands include the use of photography. So, like, for example, the image of my great-grandmother and other images. I'm obsessed with photography and obsessed with found photographs. And then at the same time, there is text. I use a lot of writing in my work as well. So that's handwriting as well as found text that sometimes gets embedded in the work and sometimes gets used in performance as well. So there are lots of different strands. But to go back to the use of my body specifically, up until 2016, I was really trying to be a figurative painter, traditional figurative painter. And basically, in 2015-16, I had a critique by a friend of mine called Rachel Arrow, who's another artist and somebody who I respect a lot. And she looked at my previous work, the last exhibition I did, which was at that time, This Is Us. And that was a series of portraits of two female dancers. And it was an expression that was talking about their relationship to each other. And they were in a polyamorous relationship. It was talking about their sexuality as well, gay women, and one of them was bisexual. So I was trying to tell this kind of love story in that work. And the critique that she gave was that she didn't feel that I was successfully expressing what I wanted to express with that work, with the technique that I was using, which was painting plus writing. And she asked me to step outside, think outside of the box, and take myself outside of this kind of traditional figurative painter, which is the majority of the time, a lot of the time, not the majority of the time, but a lot of the time, historically, especially, is a white male thing. And she asked me to think of other ways of really expressing more authentically, or authentically, full stop, really, myself. And at first, it was really a bit of a kick in the guts. It was difficult to hear at first, but then I absorbed it. I absorbed it, and I went back to the studio, and I really started to experiment and to research other artists. And I don't know, something just, I discovered Anna Mendieta. I really rediscovered Eve Klein. I discovered David Hammond, and all of these people had somehow used the body. With Eve Klein, hadn't so much used his own body. I think he had in some of his work, but in the performances, he had used women's bodies. And Anna Mendieta used her own body in land art and other performances. And then David Hammond uses his body in some of his work, but not in performance, just in his studio practice. So I don't know, something just clicked. And I felt like I needed to incorporate the use of my body into my practice. And so I started doing that in the studio, tentatively at first. It was a bit scary for a multitude of reasons. And then finally, because I was filming myself in the process of making the work in that way, I felt that this was a performative act, and I knew that I had to use performance as a means of expression as well. And it just clicked. It just clicked into place, and it felt right. And so that's, I suppose that's the how and the why. What's interesting to me is that I felt that I wanted, and I didn't really know how to express it at the time, but I felt like I wanted the audience to have a visceral experience of the work. And last night, I was watching an interview with he's not new, but a director who I hadn't heard of before. And he was describing, his way of doing documentaries, and the reason why. And he was saying that language can produce, what language produces is an experience in a way. So language can lead to empathy. But what it is to be that person expressing their experience cannot be experienced by the person experiencing the experience of the person describing the thing. Right?
So, yes, I mean, it makes sense.
Yes, so to convey an experience, to convey a visceral thing, in order to create the maximum experience, maximum impact through that experience is difficult, right? It's difficult just through the medium of language. So then he had this puzzle of creating this visceral experience through this documentary. And I feel like I was having the same issue. So for me, performance is my medium. Performance is my way of adding an extra experience onto just the physical embodiment of my work, which I make in the studio. Because anybody who's at my performances has a visceral experience of what it's like to be me, of what it's like to be going through the things that I'm going through, and they're impacted in a bigger way than if it's just the experience of the work. Do you see what I mean?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I like the fact that you mentioned also who inspired you. It's really important because it's also acknowledging that, you took inspiration by other artists, but you made it your own and you personalized it in a way that is unique. You publish your works also on social media, and that's, by the way, where I discovered you. How does this, medium helped you to evolve in your artistic career?
Social media. That's an interesting question. I don't know that it necessarily helps me to evolve personally. I think it definitely helps to disseminate what I'm doing. It definitely helps to share what I'm doing so that my work is accessible to a broader range of people than if the social media didn't exist, for example. But I don't know if it necessarily helps me to evolve. It definitely helps me to connect to more people, which then those connections may lead to personal evolutions. So a lot of the relationships that I have developed off the back of social media have led to personal evolutions. So I would say maybe in an indirect way, I feel like my work is best experienced in person than through photography or through social media. Anybody who's seen my work in real life will tell you the same thing. There are some works that translate really well on social media and are great to experience that way. But I feel like that mine is still amazing to have social media as a means of transmission. But I do feel like my work is best experienced in person. Personally,
definitely, yeah, and I think so, and I really, really hope that one day I will be able to see your performance in real life, because it's of course not the same as seeing it through images and videos. There is one last personal fight that I want to discuss with you, and it's linked to your story, because you have discovered that you suffered from endometriosis, which is a disease that pervades one out of 10 women, and it causes pain. It's a very taboo topic to discuss for many women. They don't feel like they can talk about it, but you made it a fight. And I have read that you have organized also a demonstration in front of the parliament. I think it was, maybe in 2006. Did this disease also influence the way you create as an artist? And why do you think it's more than ever important to talk about it? Did you discuss with women that are ashamed of it?
Yeah, I mean, the endometriosis is the reason I'm an artist in the first place. Because prior to being an artist, I was working in pharmaceuticals. My degree is in biology, not art. And
interesting.
And so the diagnosis of the endometriosis and the experience of endometriosis meant that I could not continue the job that I was doing. It was physically impossible for me to do so. And but I was lucky in that I had this thing, art, that I've fallen back on ever since I was a child for comfort, and as in some ways as a healing tool for me emotionally, psychologically. So so for me, when I was able to successfully switch my career path in that kind of way, and the endometriosis was the reason for that, you can't help but come to the realization that there are going to be millions of women for whom they don't have anything else to fall back on. And unless you, if you've got a partner and you've got a really understanding partner who can support you, then that's one thing. But what if you don't? What if you're on your own? What do you do? And it can be so debilitating. I'm lucky in that, for me, in terms of the worst that it got was 2011 to 2012, when I was in and out of hospital every other week. Morphine was the only thing that was keeping the pain away. There were times when I couldn't move my legs. They had to put me in a wheelchair to take me to the bathroom. They had to put me in a wheelchair to take me to have a shower, because my legs just wouldn't move, because the pain was that intense. And but for some women, this thing gets into their lungs. It can get into their brain. I know somebody who's now permanently in a wheelchair because of endometriosis. And the reason I was involved in a demonstration with the Endometriosis Society at that time was because at that time I thought I was the only one. I didn't know that other people were experiencing this. And when I found out that on average it was taking 8 years to diagnose, there wasn't a lot of research that was going into it. There wasn't very much known about the condition at all, aside from the fact that it was debilitating and people were being told to take paracetamol and being told that it's just normal period pains when they were on the floor and unable to get up. So, I have spoken to women who had felt a sense of shame. I have spoken to women who felt unable to talk about it. So I'm grateful now that we are only 14 years after I did that demonstration. There's a lot more research, a lot more people are talking about it, a lot more celebrities are talking about it and bringing awareness to it and understanding. And hopefully employers take it a lot more seriously and are more empathetic to women who are going through this. And recently the government was talking about a cash injection into more research for endometriosis. So it definitely, in terms of your question as to how it impacts my work, well, as I said, I wouldn't be an artist if it wasn't for the endometriosis. But aside from that, in terms of a direct impact on my work, I used to make work that was about the endometriosis. I used to write about it a lot as well. But more recently, I think it's more indirect in that me using my body in the way that I do in the work, that strand of my work, is a reclamation of my own body. Because there are times when I don't have any control over my body. So to be able to direct my body in the way that I do, to contort my body in performances, and to use my body to make these imprints, which then form something that's going to be left behind after I'm gone, is some kind of legacy and some kind of reminder of the power of my body. And the power of the female body. to overcome. So it's important for me.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I believe that it has been understood that you are a strong, committed and a combative woman. You have been through a very difficult time while, you know, dealing with this endometriosis, and then you didn't stay silent. You wanted to make sure that other women are aware that they're not alone on this. So this force finds its place through your work, through your arts, but also through the message that you deliver. And I think that many women need to hear this. I will conclude asking you a more broad question regarding your place in the society, but not only the British society, but in the European in general. I know that we are all in an instability time where Brexit, you know, hinders the future of the UK in the EU. But do you feel as part of Europe, and do you think that your message could be beneficial for other people living in Europe?
It's funny because Brexit has been completely overshadowed by COVID. No one talks about Brexit anymore. It's like, it's almost like...
True.
Did it really happen? Yes, it did. So, yeah, I mean, I feel that identity is a funny thing. It's a complex thing. And I feel British... I feel Ghanaian, I feel European, and I feel I'm a citizen of the world. And so I feel like what I have to say, I would like to think could have some benefit for all women in the world. Because... if just, even if you just talk about endometriosis, that impacts all, it potentially impacts something like 1 in 10 women. And that's actually a conservative estimate. They think it's probably a lot more than that. And this is globally.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's super important. And I think... yeah, it's precisely in this time of crisis, you're mentioning COVID-19, we remind ourselves that we are all in this together. And no matter what we fight for, especially when it comes to our safety, to our health, to our rights as women, as citizens, it's super important to stay united. So thank you so much for your work. And it was such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
To conclude this episode with some positive vibes, I would like to share with you my key for today, which is the TED Talk of Rachel Cargill, a Black American author, an academic, a speaker, and an activist. She did a TED Talk called Coming to Terms with Racism Inertia, Ancestral Accountability. In this TED Talk, she talks about anti-racist action, intentional accountability, but also allyship and how to be an ally and support the anti-racist action. She is also the founder of the Loveland Foundation, which is an online learning platform. So I really encourage you to check out her work and to listen to her voice. This was the end of our episode. We Belong is a podcast produced by La Cavalcade, and you can find us on all platforms and on social media. Bye!